So welcome back. Hopefully that was interactive and instructive. Anyone from any group want to say just what were some takeaways, some things you learned, some things you thought really were awful or great? Sure, Brian? Mike? Do we have the mic?
I'm Brian. I was sitting with a group over here that has since disbanded. We looked at Ann Castleman's survivalware pitch. Most people had a problem with the way that it didn't really describe what the story was until very late, if ever. Sort of its timeliness and importance weren't really there, its relevance. And we had sort of a little bit more of a sort of like forum discussion in terms of when you pitch, how to pitch, and so this sort of was a launch point for a little bit different conversation and sort of etiquette. But for the most part, this was like very product-y, and sometimes I think when you try to pitch a story idea, it can sound salesperson-y already. You're trying to sell a story idea. You're trying to sell an idea to somebody. And I think particularly in a story about a product, though you can really confuse an editor and you can kind of conflate the ideas of I'm trying to sell you this story, not I'm trying to sell you this product.
So you thought too much salesmanship.
Well, it can't, especially in the way that this is put together for a product. So while you want to, like, you know, sell an idea, in particular the way this one came across was as a product piece or a press release almost, and we had a former editor on our group who said she would have probably trashed this as PR early if she hadn't had to go all the way through it.
Mm-hmm. Boy, in a way, case in point, if we were all in one editorial meeting, no one editor, no one writer thinks the same. All publications are different. The editor's mood at the time, you know, like you were saying before, gee, they could have had several pitches like this a week before. So many things go into what makes it successful at that moment for that editor.
Well, would it be helpful if I told you what happened with the story idea?
Yeah.
Okay. So Anne is a relatively new writer for Discover, although she has a history doing some work for us. And I had asked her to pitch. And I did not perceive this necessarily as, you know, sounding like a sales pitch. But I may have been, I don't know, we are hungry for tech stories, right? And so when I read this pitch, I was like, oh, here is a tech story. And the issue I actually had with it was that it didn't seem to be necessarily relevant to Discover. Because for Discover, you would have to focus a little bit more on the science, even like the evolution of the human body and now how we need to, you know, build clothing that takes care of us. So that's kind of what we were looking for. So we went back to Anne and we said, this pitch would be great for like an adventure magazine if you want to do a profile of this guy, a business magazine. But what we really need are tech stories, and we need them for an upcoming issue in which we are having a gear guide for the year 2050. So we asked Anne to tailor her pitch and a story to that purpose.
So that goes to something that we were talking about in our group, which is that many of us have had the same experience where we work really hard to tell a story in the pitch rather than just a topic. But what the editors respond to or don't respond to is the topic. And what they will often say is, great topic, but I don't want that story. I want this story over here. Or, you know, great topic, let's talk, let's have a phone conversation about what the story is. It seems like I actually rarely have an editor say, I like your topic and your story, let's just do this. So why is it then that editors are so, is it just that you would like to see us display that we know a story when we see it? Or just as a starting point for conversation? Or why is it that topic-only pitches are not as welcome?
That's a good question. I do think that the pitch should always be perceived as the beginning of a conversation. And if you have a good story and, you, for example, you want to write a narrative and you have the elements of a narrative, it's possible you can sell a story just on that, regardless of topic. So, yeah, I want to know if you can identify what a good story is, and if it is a good one that fits within, you know, the departments or the feature well, and it's a topic. I mean, you have to address topics on some level because we can't run an entire issue full of, you know, agriculture stories. So that's where it becomes more relevant. Does that answer your question a little bit?
And just... Oh, sorry.
Right, and that's how a lot of the more informal types of pitches start. And Susan and I will get to that later, where we talk about the story that we worked on. But as a new writer for a new publication, you know, I don't think it can hurt to try to present a story.
So we have a couple more minutes. Other people from other groups. There comes Jenny.
Hi, I'm Tara, and our group is this little geographical thing here. So I was going to mention what we discussed on the Blue Dragons one, because if reading the Open Notebook one wasn't intimidating enough, I'm not sure I want to talk about it. It was a wonderful pitch. I just thought I would focus on the other one. This one, we thought it offers a story, but the story could be a little bit clearer. It took a little while for us to kind of get to what the story was, and then it sort of got muddled when she mentioned, you know, cool behavior, ecological role, and technology for conservation. So we thought maybe the story could be a little bit more clearly laid out in terms of the conservation part of it. But the story was there. It was more than a topic. The relevance was definitely there because of the interest to kids and the conservation issue, which also tied into the timeliness, because it's, you know, if they're on the brink of extinction, then it's a timely issue for that reason. And the execution appears to be written, it's in the style that you would expect the story to be written initially. I mean, she opens with two graphs that would be very possibly the lead of the actual piece. And she doesn't mention the length or anything, but that seems fine, because when you're writing for you know, a kids mag like National Geographic Kids, they probably have a standardized length, so that may not have been necessary. We thought maybe she could have mentioned more on the extras. The fact that she mentions how cool they look in the very first graph, you think maybe she would offer to take photos when she's there in the Caymans. I mean, she covers the fact that she's going to be there, so she mentions that extra, and the fact that the travel's taken care of. But it would have been good for her to say, you know, I could offer a multimedia slideshow of these blue lizards while I'm there, or something to that effect. We did think she definitely covered the author part, because she has the cred in terms of her past publications, and she knows, you know, she has kids that are in the age group that she's writing for. So,
very comprehensive critique. Should we hear from the writer herself? Do you have a quick one, Jim?
That assignment was something, I mean, I pitched it just as I wrote there, because my family decided to go to Grand Cayman for a vacation. And this getting back to the bigger point that Sarah made about thinking about freelancing as part of your larger strategy for your life. You know, this was 5 or 6 years ago now, I guess. So my daughters were pretty small. I don't do long travel things for work. Typically, I go to conferences a few times a year, and I don't spend 3 months in Peru, you know, stuff like that. But when I'm going somewhere interesting, I usually try to think, is there something interesting there I could do? You know, not to try to work on vacation all the time, but Grand Cayman, I thought, well, there must be something interesting on Grand Cayman. It's a story idea. Very quickly found out about these blue iguanas and their situation, and just thought, you know, it would be fun to do something simple. And I had been wanting, because my background is in government and public policy, and I sort of came into journalism sideways from doing environmental advocacy work and a lot of other stuff like that. So I actually tend to write a lot of very wonky stuff about things like, you know, renewable energy credits and tradable permits and stuff like that. And I wanted to do stuff that was simpler and just, you know, more sort of, this is what's happening now, and also written in more sort of fun and, you know, humorous styles when you can. And so I just thought, I'm just going to try to sell a cool sort of creature feature story about these iguanas. And so I sent it to National Geographic Kids, and it ran as a one-page creature feature kind of department that they have. It's a good point about offering photographs, but since it was National Geographic Kids, they pull from National Geographic's library, so it never even occurred to me to go there. I just was not really, you know, I wasn't on that. I wouldn't offer National Geographic photographs now, honestly. But one other thing I'll say about it, which just worked out really nicely, was that I asked our tax advisor, who's, you know, fairly aggressive but not crazy on this stuff, so what could I deduct
for having done this story, because I did literally. We went to this botanic garden and learned about them and, you know, spent half a day there. She said, your plane ticket and one day worth of expenses for you. And on Grand Cayman, that's a lot. I took the U.S. government, the State Department per diem for Grand Cayman, and the tax break that we got, the tax savings were larger than the fee that I got paid for the article. But, you know, it's just, if you think of sort of times when you can do something like that, you know, sometimes it's surprising how beneficial it can be. And it was really fun to do. So.
Okay, anything else burning as a report on another one? Okay.
The pitch on the brain was very detailed, and obviously the author knows a lot about the subject, but we found it kind of confusing because there's two different ideas. One, that you sort of reach the limit of computing power, another that you sort of reach the limit of the human brain, and the connection isn't made firmly enough between the two. And it is also very long for a query. But it's a fascinating subject, but you'd have to have a very specialized audience to go for a pitch like this, in our view.
I tend to like shorter pitches. I tend to like shorter pitches, too. That was a lot of text. But what I liked about Doug's pitch and Anne's pitch was that they were a little bit longer, but in that length, like, I became confident that they'd done some research and really knew the topic. And so when we started the conversation about how to shape a story, I knew we weren't starting from ground zero, basically. Although I didn't work with Doug on that story, but with Anne. Okay. You said something back there about you guys got into a discussion about pitch etiquette, and maybe we can revisit that later in the Q&A section. I'd be curious to know what that was. Okay, so just a tiny bit about pitch hygiene. If you have drafted your query letter, and I hope we haven't served to confuse everybody about what a good query letter is, since it obviously varies a lot from person and publication. But when you are ready to send, a couple of things have emerged as best practice. Find a person on staff to send your query to. Obviously, you probably all know this. If you send it to editorial at Discover Magazine, it's probably never going to get read, unfortunately. Yes. I think emails are always preferred, so putting the pitch in the email instead of sending attachments. And making sure, if you're not using Gmail, for example, that the entire email thread is there, so that you're just basically trying to make this as easy as possible, right, for the editor in a way. So you don't want them to have to go dig for attachments or piece together parts of a conversation. Make sure you put pitch in your subject heading so that editors can search for those in their inboxes. And if it's time sensitive, make sure you say as much so that they know to open it immediately. And then this question of follow-up, I think it was part of one of your responses to the Cylance survey, too. I think it's incredibly frustrating when you don't get a response. And so what is the appropriate amount of time to follow up with somebody? I would say a week or two for me in magazines. I don't know. I was editing National Geographic news content. Obviously, that's a much faster turnaround. You want a response within hours or a day. Yeah, so you're probably dealing with a new service, right, if you're covering embargoed issues or maybe an online content provider. And so I imagine the turnaround would be much quicker for those. I imagine you'd want a response than those. Yeah, something that indicates you need a response sooner rather than later. And then I think Jim was saying this before, too. As an editor, I get hundreds of queries, and they're not always from people I know, and so it is helpful if you, as a writer, email me again if you haven't heard from me, and maybe you can call if you haven't heard from me in a couple of weeks. But it does help. It's a nudge. It's a helpful reminder. I don't think editors want to be bombarded every week or day with emails and phone calls from the same writer. And then I think we need to emphasize that you should view any response you get to a pitch as an opportunity to learn. It's not a rejection of your work or you. It may be a rejection of the idea. And as someone in the group I was with said, like, as a writer, you sometimes become an advocate for an idea. And so when if your pitch is not accepted, it's because the idea wasn't maybe right for that outlet at the time, or, you know, they had something similar already in the works. So just to not take things too personally. Yeah.
How do you feel about giving feedback on that versus I had something in public? And I've been curious, why did she go? Is it because of the individual that she was familiar with or wrote about, or because that would help good official to know why she
did. Did you ask?
No.
It can't hurt, right?
If
you like very, you know, very politely, if you have time, I'd be curious to know. I'm learning how to navigate the system, and I think some editors are responsive to that.
Okay, so I want to leave plenty of time for questions. So we just wanted to walk through a couple scenarios, with the main message being pitching, as we've talked about before, it's not necessarily a done deal, that very first pitch, but it is a duet, not a duel. So it is a whole process, often, maybe sometimes not, but of a back and forth. So it's kind of collaboration to shape the story. So I just want to walk through a bit of our duet on this Nitrogen Underground story that I wrote, what was it, in the July-August issue of Discover. So it's kind of been one of my nearest obsessions since about 2008 or 9, when on a backpacking trip my husband turned around and said, you should write about nitrogen. I'm like, what the hell? And at the time it was when natural gas prices were shooting through the roof, and it was sort of a global food security and economic issue. And then I got really interested in it, and it's like, what are these microbes doing? And I didn't know N from P from K in terms of gardening at the time. But anyway, so I've done some sort of a history of doing some coverage. So thus begin. Actually, well, I'll just start with, it was just an email to Tasha not long after she came on to Discover, just saying, in general, are you looking for certain kinds of topics or not looking for certain kinds of topics?
Yeah, and so this is actually fairly typical of how stories become assignments for the magazine. So Susan asked what I was looking for, which is appreciated. And then this goes back to the topic versus story question. Like, I knew that we needed environment stories in the magazine. I knew that there might be something interesting going on with nutrient pollution, but I did not have the time to research this and find a story. So I knew Susan was obsessed with nitrogen, and I basically asked her if she knew of any good stories that she would like to pitch us related to nitrogen. Susan responds with enthusiasm. And that's when she submitted what is essentially what I call a pre-pitch, and I think you have a copy of it, where she just kind of, brain dump is not the right word, but
slightly between a brain dump and a refined pitch.
Yeah.
But I was looking for, not profiles, but certain scientists to wrap the story around. So I started with this guy, really cool guy, UNC, Hans Perl, does a lot of work in China and here, and your response? Anyway, so you can, at your leisure, read that pre-pitch.
Right, and in a way, it just presented options for stories. And so then I took that back to the edit meeting, and we discussed it, and we liked it, and so then we asked Susan to present a full pitch and where she would focus the story a little bit more and narrow down a single story that she could tell for us.
And I was so excited, because I thought I would get to go to China.
I know.
But
sorry.
But I got to go to UC Davis instead.
And after I came back from the editorial meeting and had the pleasure of calling Susan and saying, hey, we're interested, you know, I always offer up having a conversation with the writer if they want help in shaping the full pitch, because sometimes that saves everyone time in the end. And then, very quickly, yeah. Right, so if... I don't know if you had a chance to read those two, but in the pre-pitch, it's somewhere between, and correct me if you think differently, somewhere between topic and story, where we knew we wanted something on nitrogen, and basically in that pre-pitch, Susan presented a series of angles or stories that we could tell. And then from there, we narrowed it down and refined it. So yeah, she very quickly turned around a beautiful, complete pitch. And then we commissioned the story. And that's when the discussion about word length and expenses and rates started.
Enough said on that one. And then another kind of a pitch that we talked about in here, I call it an iterative pitch. So there's the phoenix, you get the idea. So rejection is not rejection of you necessarily, or more importantly, it's not the final word. So this is a story, maybe just click on the URL, that I ultimately did in September issue of Popular Science. I had first pitched to Wired, I think a year before or something. I just came across this 10-year-old kid who's kind of a rising star now in the maker movement, and this is more of a tech and electronics and a STEM education story, and wasn't really coming at it as as a topic, but I was just kind of obsessed with this kid, and then learned more about the maker movement and yada, yada, yada. So one of the first things this kid made to get other kids interested in electronics was a fart sensor, a methane sensor. So he made this so-called gas cap. So Wired's like, all right, we just want a story about the fart sensor. And I actually wanted something broader than that. So I think you were talking about that, Emma. So when do you sort of politely say, actually, I don't think that's really my story? And then I thought, well, maybe it's sort of a tech/business/education story for the New York Times, but didn't quite fit there either. And then, this may happen to a lot of you, this wasn't a formal pitch initially, but at last year's AAAS conference, I just sat down with the editor and we were going through different ideas, and I could see her eyes were a little glazed over on the environmental stuff, and I said, well, here's something I'm really interested in, and she totally grabbed onto that and then said, give me a formal pitch when you get back, and one thing led to another. So I won't go into the story, but it's more the process of how it can be really useful to get a rejection and then see, well, is there another venue? It's a different story from what I originally had pitched for sure, but... And then a little different from what Dan was describing is holding on to sort of a theme or a beat and doing a lot with that, or Michael Kodas for that matter. You're doing books, you're doing articles. I wouldn't say I'm this on the maker movement, but it's just learning how to resurrect from a rejection, basically. Okay, and then one more quick example, maybe we could call it the story. So a story a couple weeks ago that came out in, people written for know the publication NCIA, used to be Momentum out of University of Minnesota. So this I had originally pitched, I forget. Oh no, actually it was the editor who came to me. So just an example of you're taking sort of a topic or a story about nitrogen, and knew I had a book's worth, still considering a book maybe, but worth of research on it, and just trying to go to other publications and do different types of stories. And in this case, the editor also said, we're interested in something on legumes and biological nitrogen fixation, and we've seen some of your stuff. Could you give me an idea, a pitch? So it led to that. Okay, so basically that's it. Just some ideas, Science Writer's Handbook, certainly. Resource for everyone. It just has so many chapters on the business and the writing side. And then the Open Notebook. And Poynter Institute, I think, has really good webinars, other resources. I'm sure some people have been there at their campus.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned it before, the Open Notebook has a pitch database where you can go look at pitches that have been accepted and turned into stories. And they also have a really interesting roundtable discussion up there with a bunch of editors about pitches and pet peeves and how not to pitch, basically.
So now you. Any questions? Comments?
I'm Brian.
Brian one more time. This is for Tasha. It's just a question about something that I think gets lost in the discussion sometimes from the writer's side. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about, from the editor's perspective, you know, a lot of editors are looking for a stable of writers. They want good writers. And if you're a writer and you're pitching, you're hopefully developing a relationship with an editor who's looking for you. So sometimes I think that we forget about that, and we forget that we're, you know, on the other side of the wall is an editor who's looking for a good writer and not just a good story. I wonder if you could talk about your experience a little bit about that and just address that a little bit, because I think that gets lost sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very true. And as I said, we rely very heavily on freelance writers, and we want freelance writers that we can depend on, we can go to with topics, and they can turn them into stories. And that is a relationship built over time. So that relationship might start with the type of pitch that you were reading, or an even more refined version of it, where it becomes obvious that this is a good writer, they have a voice or a style that fits with the magazine, they understand the outlet, they know how to do good research, which is surprisingly hard to find sometimes. And so that building of confidence starts maybe, if you're a new writer, with that initial pitch letter where you show that you can do those things. And then if you get that assignment, and we talked about this in the group that I was in too, like if you get that assignment, maybe the next pitch letter doesn't have to be as thorough. And now I work with writers who, you know, just say, I want to do a story about this, and I say, great, I trust that you can do it. So, yeah. Does that answer your question?
Anyone else? Bear? Roger?
Tell me how this affects you, either positively or negative. One word, bullets.
Duck. No, I don't think they're necessarily bad. I think they can help you organize a pitch. Jim, did you have something to...
Wait, Doug Fox had several?
Yeah.
Or was
yeah.
that the Antarctica pitch for you?
Anyway. Because there has to be a point in that pitch where there is like a very clear, concise statement. This is what the story is. This is how it's going to be executed. And if that's a tool for doing that, I don't, you know, you don't want to.
Sometimes you hear people say they immediately turn it off when they see a bulletin, you know, statement. I'm curious.
That's not me. Yeah, again, it's like... editor per editor, but it, you know, some editors will automatically discount your pitch if you put a link in there too. So it depends. Yeah.
I wanted to ask Tasha, as an editor, and I've been in many editorial meetings. I've seen this happen where, if you bring a story into a meeting, you're sort of the defender of that story, and you're presenting it to the group. And what I found is like two or three people can like it, but one person can shoot it down really easily just by saying something. Simple, we've already done that. If one person says that, that kills the pitch in the room. And you go on to something else. And then you have to tell the poor writer that for no particular reason, their story was killed. I just wondered if you've had that experience.
Yeah, and I guess it depends on who that person is. it's much harder to convince the editor-in-chief.
Yeah.
Than, you know. But I think... I don't know, going back to sort of building that confidence and trust in those relationships between writers and editors, when I do walk into the room, I'm essentially pitching the story to the edit staff, and so I'm an advocate for I become the advocate for the idea and an advocate for the writer. And so by the time I bring it to a pitch meeting, I need to know that, like, the writer who proposed that idea can deliver what they promised. And that comes out in the pitch or through conversations. And then I have more fuel when people are skeptical of the idea. And sometimes it becomes, you know, a debate. And sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. And it is frustrating because sometimes you can't give a concrete reason to a writer about why their pitch was rejected. Yeah.
Emma?
I have another question about form. Some of the pitches that we looked at in our groups sort of had leads. They had sort of more gradual or colorful introductions, especially Doug's. Starts with this supercomputer and kind of sets a scene. So you hear that you're supposed to write the pitch kind of similarly to how you'd write the article, so that would seem to imply that you should write a lead for your pitch. But on the other hand, you also hear that editors are super, super busy and you just need to get right to the point and tell them what the story is right away. So lead or no lead?
Someone else can weigh in too, but I imagine that has to do with the format and what you're proposing, like for a news story, for example, or something that maybe isn't as narrative. Probably do want to get to the point faster. But in the case of Doug's and Anne's, like I definitely, because we primarily publish narratives, I wanted to know what they could do in terms of creating those narrative elements. And so I was interested in reading their lead, and I wanted to make sure that the pitch held my interest for several graphs before I got to the point where they said, this is what the story is, and this is how I will tell it.
Yes. One topic I'm passionate about is food sustainability, food security, and that's a very local issue. And I've been thinking a great deal about how can we feed Nashville, Tennessee, solely with organic farming. That's also a national issue. And so as I listen and think this through, what is a good source of finding national magazines that may be dedicated to it, a specific topic that you want to write about? Just Google it? Or, I mean, you know, what do people do to find those publications?
Can you only speak to Discover now? Now that you're on the other side. You know, it's a combination. I keep going back to silence, community, and Lena, I'll turn to you in a bit. Just the power of community, the power of friends who are also freelancers. Hey, I have this idea about this. Who have you written for or what? I mean, I know, Dan, you said, what, years ago maybe you went to the grocery store and actually looked at magazines. I still think looking at magazines, I mean, Writer's Market, it may sound a little archaic, but Writer's Market, the website, does have magazines by thematic areas and by consumer or trade segments. That's sort of really basic. I don't know, other suggestions?
Yeah, a university or a public library with a periodicals room. It's one of my favorite ways to procrastinate when I really don't want to write is I pretend that I'm doing market research and then I go down and just spend an afternoon in the periodicals room reading weird magazines I've never heard of before.
I love it. That's great. Okay, and another question or two, and then we've got 12 minutes.
Hi. I was wondering how much you think writers should fight back if they get rejected, or if their idea gets rejected.
You know, kind of a follow-up to what we were just talking about with the edit meetings. It is often the case where someone in the room doesn't like the idea, but then I fight for it and say, well, what if we got this additional information from the writer or had them look at it in this way? And then I go back to the writer. And so in a way, that's still fighting for the story. But if you get a flat-out no, maybe one follow-up asking why, if you didn't get that reason already, and is there anything you can do that would make it more appropriate for the outlet? But I don't know. Again, it's not a personal rejection. It just might be that the idea didn't fit that month or year in the magazine.
I want to speak briefly to, I think what's a really complicated thing and has been for me is not an outright rejection. That's easier to deal with because then I just say thanks and what can I learn and move on. But it's the yes, maybe, give us a little more, give us a little more research, give us a pre-pitch, give us more of a pitch. And I think actually one publication in particular just putting so much time. And then I hear what Dan Baum, the former writer of The New Yorker, said maybe two-thirds of his time he would put into the research for the pitch. So some people just expect it's going to take that much time. But for me, it's this limbo land where it's a maybe. It's not quite a rejection. It's not quite yes. And I'm like, how many? You know, if the dollar per hour, I did the calculus on that, it'd be really scary. And then sometimes in this case, just said, you know, I think it's time to move on. And I couldn't tell if it was an editor just not quite ready to say no or the editor still was fighting with the editorial folks. Anyway.
My name's Connie. In the same line of protecting your copyright if you're a photographer, and this probably would most likely be smaller publications, but you make a pitch and it's not accepted, and all of a sudden there's your story. Someone's borrowed your pitch.
You've had this happen?
Not really, sort of.
I think it's more apocryphal than really. I mean, I know you have had it. Karen Schaefer can confirm. I mean, it's clearly unethical. I think it's rare, but it's bad if it happens at all. I think it's worth saying something to the editor and never pitching there again.
And when you say it's been used without your permission, that was like the specific story that you proposed, or it was the topic? The very specific story. Yeah. I mean, that is really unfortunate. I can imagine, like, I don't want to defend anybody's bad behavior, but I can imagine scenarios where, like, if you're talking about a trending topic, you're not the only person maybe that pitched that story, or maybe they were already discussing it on staff, but that's giving people the benefit of the doubt.
Another one?
Sorry. Thanks. This is a question about working with the editor. I believe one of you used that phrase. Because I've had different experiences, and just to get to my question, you do the pitch, and you get an acceptance, and then you're expected to write it within a certain deadline. So I'm busy, and I wrote it. In another case, I did the pitch. It was accepted, and they gave me 3 days to do it, a three-day deadline, and I was traveling at the time. And it wasn't an easy thing for me to pull off. So I responded, I'm traveling. I'll do my best to meet your deadline. Can you give me some guidance on how to shape this story? And the editor did, and it was very helpful, and I met the deadline. But my question is that appropriate? Is it appropriate to ask editor for that kind of guidance, or should is the editor thinking, well, she should know how to do this, she sent me the pitch?
I would always prefer, and this maybe is from a magazine narrative perspective, but I would always prefer to have multiple conversations with the writer before they even start writing, to come to some sort of agreement about what the story will look like, so that there are no surprises later down the road. And maybe that's different for shorter form.
Couple more questions.
I'm just working on one of my first print pieces, a fairly lengthy one, in some years, and I sat down and had a person-to-person discussion with the editor of a new online investigative journalism magazine in Ohio, and I thought we were very clear on what the topic was, and I sent her the script. And, sorry, you call it something else. The draft. I'm used to radio. I sent her the draft.
Wait, you sent a draft before you got an assignment?
And after. And then she called me the next day, and this hurts, but I'll say it. She said, have you reported before? And I said, wait a minute, what? What's the problem? And so she described what she saw as, well, she described a very different story from the one we talked about. And she wants me to do a complete rewrite. And I'm fine with that. That's good. If an editor wants something different, I'll do it. But, you know, what should I do? This isn't the first time I've worked with editors. I've had them in radio, too, who say, well, that's not the story I wanted, but that's the story you asked for. Okay. So what do you do in that situation?
Yeah,
but I need to create a relationship with this editor because I want to work with her.
I don't know, and you may have experience with this too, but I don't know how it works in radio. With the stories that I'm working on, it is this conversation where you come to agreement with the story is, and then the next step, and this seems to work for both writer and editor, is to create an outline and sign off on it. So I guess the more steps you build into the process, the less likely you are to... Yeah, it's been helpful.
Question? Probably time for one or two more.
Tara, you know how we've talked a lot about, well, a little bit about when you
take one story idea or one topic that has a couple of different stories and you use it for multiple publications or you try and repurpose it. It's sort of a twofold question in that, first of all, to what extent do you inform editors that, like, if you've written about something twice now in major publications, but you're repurposing it for a new publication, you're specializing it to them, do you tell them that this will have some elements similar to the stories I wrote for such and such and such and such? Or, you know, is there a point over where the overlap is too much, and how do you determine where, I mean, I'm sure there is, but how do you determine where that overlap is too much or it's too similar and that?
Someone, a friend, Bruce Barcott, had an email thread once saying, can you self-plagiarize? And sometimes we have wondered, like, am I plucking some of the reporting? Like, I just did the story I did for NCIA had some reporting from a trip to Africa and Rwanda with a nitrogen scientist 2 years before. I made that really clear to her. Like, it'd be cool to have a little narrative. I wasn't stealing from another article, but it was some of the reporting I had used before. I think that's pretty typical, and in fact, I know, I'm sure there's a whole gamut of views on it, but I think more often than not, you can use that to your favor. It's like, here's what I've done. In fact, it's often in my pitch, if it's a cold call pitch, it's just links. I know you hate links at the end, but sort of here are some examples of other things I've done on the topic. And then it's a whole long conversation that we probably don't have time for, but all the gradations of using some other reporting, or let's say my trip to UC Davis, now so-and-so is going to be a source in another story, but I wouldn't pull the actual scenes or the actual quotes, anything like that. And it basically, when in doubt, ask. When in doubt, bring it up, and bring it up like sooner than later. Disclosure or ethical questions as a segue to that?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I would echo that it should be a conversation, and that happens fairly regularly, and I really appreciate when writers come to me and say, hey, I'm thinking about doing this, does that sound okay? And I mean, 90% of the time it is, so.
If you do an interview with someone and you use X, Y, and Z quotes from that interview for this publication, and you have other really good choice quotes from the same interview with that person, but you did not use them, is it unethical to use those other quotes from the same interview for a different publication, as long as you're not reusing the quotes? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. That's a really sticky one. It's my eyebrows. I think it's okay because you didn't use those quotes, but I would also bring it up with an editor. What do you think, Jenny?
On that, I've never had a contract like this before, but I know there are some all rights contracts where they actually say that they buy the rights to your notes and all the research that you do. I've never even seen one like that, let alone signed it, and I wouldn't sign it. I mean, I do contracts that are all rights, but certainly not. They don't get all the material. But you would really want to make sure you didn't have any restrictions like that.
Anything? Okay, well, with that perfect segue to the ethics session, I want to thank everything. Actually, before we break, did Lena leave? Not to put her on the spot. Anyway, I saw her at the airport, Lena Straub, and she was saying it was after your freelance workshop last year that I formed, well, you talk about it, the Yaya Sisters of the Traveling Pen or something. I just want to stress the importance of community. Like, this is, hopefully we've taught all collectively something and we will continue, but it's really about you bonding with others in however formal, informal way it is, whether it's to share a pitch, whether it's to, you know, bare your soul when you have a baby or whatever. But I think it really helps to form community, so.
After the last conference, a number of, I guess was it your first conference last year? Second, okay. And I know it was Lana Straub's first conference and fourth or fifth. But I was, you know, back to freelancing. I'd been a full-time person before. And Lana, probably I should let her talk about this, decided we're going to form this little Facebook sisterhood called, I don't know, Sisters of... Yeah, Sisters...
Sisterhood of the Traveling Pin.
And what we want to know is... what it's done for the members of the group.
Oh, okay. Well, we spent a lot of time in the bar last year. Anyway, that doesn't matter. Okay, all right. I know what that means in radio. Anyway, basically what the group has done is we take little things that we know, like I've done freelance print for a long time, and Karen's trying to get into it, so I swap with her. You know, she's taught me some radio. Fawn can tell you. What has it done for you, Fawn? Yes.
Sometimes I think if it weren't for that, having a couple different really important communities, I would not be a freelancer. Now it's just so damn lonely sometimes. On that great note, no. So anyway, yeah, really, community and persistence and professionalism. So thanks so much, and 2:30 reconvene for the ethics panel.